Bat Segundo here. I hope you're a lot happier than I am. This week, our young roving correspondent insisted on pressing a high-profile interview in front of my face. I'm not sure why. After all, the writer in question writes long, arcane books that I don't entirely understand, but that our young roving correspondent seems to respond to with glee. And if writing 900-page books, or even 4,000-page books, was the way to win friends and influence people, well, I would have stopped DJing many moons ago. This week's guest is William T. Volman. He is the author of some 200 books. I wouldn't know. I stopped counting after the royal family. Anyway, I have very little to say about Mr. Volman because I apparently lack the smarts to understand his work. No matter. His latest book is On Centering the Earth, which deals with Copernicus theory and possibly something else. I wouldn't know, I was never very good at science, but perhaps the idea here is that being in the center of something isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Personally, I stopped trying to understand Copernican theory when an old flame of mine suggested to me that I shouldn't be in the center of our relationship. Never mind that I paid for her breast implants and other surgical procedures that she apparently didn't care for. Well, kids, she stuck around. But then again, I've never been particularly good with women. But as it turns out, Volman is more of a charmer than I. It's too bad I wasn't there to take notes.
Okay, I am here with the one, the only, William T. Volman, recent author of Uncentering the Earth, a book involving Copernicus. Bill, how are you doing today?
So far, so good, thanks.
Okay. Now, one interesting thing about this book that I observed was back in Copernicus's day, there was absolutely no separation between religion and science, as I noted. And you used the phrase that Copernicus used, what could be more beautiful than the heavens, which contain all beautiful things? And that would be sort of unthinkable, I think, today in like sort of a white paper, you know, or anything like that.
It's a gain and a loss.
Yes. Do you think that, I was going to ask you, what do you think has been lost in sort of sequestering these two elements or this particular element out of sort of a statement of facts? Or is this where writers like you come in?
Well, sorry, I'm crunching my cookie here. Dante's Divine Comedy could not have been written without, you know, what I call scriptural astronomy. Basically, you know, in those days, there was no theory of motion independent from the thing being moved. Each of the four classical elements had its own motion. So it made sense that because Earth was the heaviest element, it would always fall and therefore be at the center of the universe. And because divinity is light and sin is heavy, then of course hell is going to be below the surface of the Earth at the very center. And so not only did he have this, you know, very, very beautiful, convincing, symmetrical allegory, but it even made sense, you know, in accordance with the facts of physics as it was then understood. So it really had a double power, and that's what makes it so neat. I mean, you could come up with some sort of allegory now, I'm sure, and make it very well worked out, and it might be as great a book in its way, but deep down, you would know that you were creating something instead of expressing something that everybody knew was true, you know? And that has to affect what you're doing.
Well, sure. And you also point out, actually, one thing that I didn't know anything about was the Ptolemaic sort of equant and the epicenter. These efforts to, the phrase you use is save the circumstances, the phrase actually that Ptolemy uses. And do you find, it seems to me that this book is not just about sort of Copernican theory, but it's also about sort of the effort to kind of contextualize this. Do you feel that this is just as essential to understanding Copernicus?
I think it is. I mean, he was a great man, especially when you consider how limited he was. In other words, how much like all of us, how human. And he really took the tiniest step forward and probably without seeing what the consequences were going to be. And, you know, why would he keep saying things like, the mind shudders when he imagines possibility of a non-circular orbit? You know, that's what I wanted to understand. Because the truth is, I mean, you know, the planets go around the sun in ellipses, and if he had just worked out the details of an elliptical orbit, he wouldn't have needed all those circles. Things would have been so much simpler. He just couldn't bring himself to do it.
Well, the thing that also is interesting about that is that it also reminds me very much of intelligent design, the equant in the epicenters. I was wondering if you were intending to draw some contemporary parallels.
There are always contemporary parallels. I mean, the one that I am drawing now is with the war on Iraq. I thought that, you know, from the very beginning that it was, you know, a criminal, unjust, stupid war. But even if people didn't think so, the fact is that now it's clear that it's a mistake and nobody knows how to get out of it. And at some point, the Ptolemaic universe became an embarrassment. And they could keep adding as many circles within circles as they wanted, but they still couldn't quite patch it up. And so, but they couldn't bring themselves to scrap it, you know? And that's why, you know, the church really turned on the Copernicans so much. It was just, what a nightmare to have to start over. And that's human nature.
Well, it's also, too, that you point out also that the sphere or the circles were very sort of like almost deified in this book.
That's true.
Did you sort of, I don't know if you could comment upon this, but to sort of draw a contemporary sort of parallels, I used the Marx's cash nexus as an example of a contemporary parallel of something that's worshipped.
Right.
What would be today's circle?
Well, definitely, the cash nexus still. I mean, you know, everywhere you go, people are talking about, oh, I have to sell myself, and I want to go and buy something. And how can I improve my career? How can I get ahead? This is stuff that we think is what everybody, you know, is focused on. But it's not true. You go to Mexico, and people are more interested in being free and in having time at their disposal. You read about the ancient Greeks, and they were interested in prestige, but nobody really had anything. You know, the man who had the most money would probably dedicate a statue of some goddess with it or something like that, and everyone would say how great he was, but he didn't take things home.
There's an interesting sort of parallel, I think, between Uncentering the Earth and Europe Central in that you both books deal in part with a figure who is up against some sort of oppressive state. You have Copernicus up against, obviously, the church, and in Europe Central, quite movingly, you have Shostakovich being, you know, turned into this, you know, they're trying to turn him into a communist, and I'm not going to reveal the ending. I'll let the readers read that for themselves. But I guess I wanted to ask you, do you think the Bush administration might be sort of your muse, or...?
Well, I think that I think we're already in some bad repressive times, and I think those times are, you know, are probably going to turn into worse times. I don't think yet that we're, you know, in the times as bad as the things that Shostakovich had to experience, or even. Yeah, maybe it's sort of equivalent to what Copernicus went through in his lifetime, that if you were kind of careful and didn't really push things too much, that no one was going to bother you. I'm sure if you, you know, decided that you wanted to start a child porn Al-Qaeda website, you could get yourself in plenty of trouble.
You have mentioned repeatedly that you are sort of a political novelist or a political writer. Are these sort of commentaries of Shostakovich against the Soviets or you know, even here in this book, you know, Copernicus against the Church, are these ways to sort of find a kind of level of political writing that isn't, I guess, didactic? Or, I mean, how do you sort of, like, you know, find that kind of happy medium between sort of, like, writing with political content versus just hitting you over the head with didacticism?
I'm interested in people at some kind of moment of decision. And often, you know, that's a moment of crisis which has been brought about by politics. So I'm less interested in politics in and of itself than in politics as it is a force that affects people. A lot of the people in my novels, you know, are down and outs who have no understanding of politics in and of itself, but they're still victims of class politics. Shostakovich was very conscious of politics because he lived in a politicized society and he was an intellectual. Copernicus probably was more naive about politics than Shostakovich, but also he was allowed to keep to himself more, and he was not considered a threat.
One thing I wanted to ask you is that now that you've finished Rising Up and Rising Down, which you consider your life's work, are you done sort of throwing yourself, you know, into war zones or freezing in the Arctic?
I hope not. Yeah.
You hope not?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right now, I'm having a great time doing other things. I'm working on briefer works of nonfiction. There's a book about poor people that's going to come out next year. And basically, I went around lots of different places in the world asking poor people why they thought they were poor and trying to make sense of the answers. And I'm working on a longish book, but not as long as Rising Up and Rising Down, about the California-Mexico border. It's a history of the border. And also...
Is that imperial?
Yeah. It's
okay.
Yeah.
So you're still working on that?
Yeah, I'm hoping to finish it this year.
Okay.
And I'm writing a book about Japanese no theater, which is fascinating to me. And hoping to finish that this year as well. You know, I'm really glad that I got to educate myself when I was writing Rising Up and Rising Down. It was a very unpleasant subject, and now I would like to do some things that sort of help me at least figure out how to make the world a little better. And Rising Up and Rising Down was the beginning of that. It had a moral calculus. But creating a set of rules is a lot easier than applying them in specific situations. And even with the poor people book, you know, basically, there's not a lot that I can recommend to do about poverty. But if you consider the fact that every human being has his own reality and his consciousness, and that if you can understand how it is that people perceive and express their own poverty, then maybe you might be able to give them some suggestions on how to interpret their own poverty to themselves in a way that is going to make them happier. So I'm well-meaning with that, at least. Who knows if I can actually pull it off. And then with the No book, that's pure pleasure, because what I'm very interested in is feminine beauty. I've always had a weakness for girls. So even if they're actually old men dressed up as girls, it's still great.
Well, this kind of ties into the research you do. I wanted to kind of compare the research for the last two books, Uncentering and Europe Central. They're both different in their own way. I mean, you're very, very meticulous about these references. But, like, for example, in the case of Europe Central, you have in the afterword the imaginary love triangle, that a lot of these sort of, you know, details have kind of been come from your imagination. And I was wondering, at what point does the sort of, you know, the distance between imagination and fact sort of stop in a novel like Europe Central? And then furthermore, an additional kind of related question, are these reference points in aid for the sort of reader to kind of take off and sort of submerge themselves into the similar world that you've explored, or what's the deal with this?
Well, I just like to play fair with the reader. And I think that if someone reads this and maybe hasn't had the benefit of doing as much research on the topic as I have, maybe he's not sure whether this or that is true, but he's interested. And he might be interested in some particular thing, maybe some bizarre occurrence that happened to Shostakovich or whatever grabbed his attention. He can look it up in the notes. He can see, oh yeah, this did really happen, and here's where I can find out about it. And maybe he'll be encouraged to educate himself further about World War II or about the Soviet Union or whatever, you know? And it's a way of keeping myself honest too, and paying my debts, because when I quote, you know, I was trying to bring Shostakovich to life, so I wanted him to speak the way the real Shostakovich would have spoken, as much as I could. So the way that I began doing that was by writing down verbatim things that Shostakovich had said. So it's okay to steal those, but I think you should note when you do, and not just plagiarize them. And you know, after I do that for a while, then I say, okay, I get it. So if I'm going to be talking like Shostakovich, I kind of stutter and stammer, and I'm always about to say something really depressing and horrible. So I quickly change the subject and veer off, and then I get trapped in some other horrible thing. And just kind of circle around and round it like a prisoner. That's what my Shostakovich is going to do. And after a while, then, you know, I can whip off that dialogue, no problem. But in the meantime, the ones that I started with, everything that actually comes from him or from people who remember what he said, it's there. So I'm not saying, you know, I made this up. Here it is. I think that's good for everybody.
There's also the interesting things I like about the Shostakovich in Europe Central is all the well you knows, which also kind of ties into another sort of Volman motif, which is the repetitive phrases. Particularly in the last couple of books you've read, you very, very much, like we were talking earlier about, sort of like, you know, saves the circumstances and the mind, you know, shudders.
Right.
You know, so what is this kind of like a more recent motif that I've noticed in your books? It's not so much in sort of like, you know, You Brighten Risen Angels or The Rainbow Stories. I was wondering if you can kind of talk about that.
I think that that you can consider a book to be like a poem or a symphony, and you can create a motif, you know, as say Wagner did, and when you want to, you bring the motif back, if you do it right, it instantly jogs people's memory, puts them in a certain kind of mood, and they say, okay, yeah, I get it, and then you can also vary it when you want to. So at one point, you know, like there's this the Stalin slogan that goes all the way through Europe Central, you know, life has become better, comrades. And, you know, toward the end, I have Shostakovich saying things like, life has become bitter, comrades, you know? So it's fun to return to things and then to play with them, too.
The other sort of motif, stylistic motif I wanted to talk about was discovered by Madison Smart Bell. He was the first academic sort of booster of yours to notice that, and that is the sort of the narrator who leads the audience there. In Europe Central, you have, for example, Comrade Alexandrov. I was wondering if you could sort of talk about this. I know Smart Bell sort of says that it's kind of like a quest for ocular proof, that it sort of establishes trust between the audience and you, the author. So I was wondering if you could sort of elaborate on how this evolved. Le Triomont, I think, was one of the sort of key incidents, but I want to hear from the horse's mouth here.
There you go. Well, you know, the narrative voice does different things in different books. And sometimes, as in an Afghanistan picture show, it's pretty sincerely me. And it's, sometimes it's the older me commenting on the younger me, or, you know, extracts from the younger me's diary and so on and so forth. But it's basically just different layers of the same real person. And then with Europe Central, there are a lot of changes of the narrative voice all the way through. For instance, when General Vlasa is still under Soviet control, we refers to the Soviet Union. And then after he gets captured and gradually becomes compromised and starts working for the Nazis, we becomes a German we, and goes back and forth. And Comrade Alexandrov is, he's often kind of a subtle presence, and he's not a completely reliable narrator many of the times. For instance, the real Yelena Konstantinovskaya had one kind of hair, and he's insisting that she had a different kind of hair. And he's telling you right off the bat that she looked like one kind of person, but he loves her and she's another kind of person. And he's going to tell the story his way, and he's going to alter the police files and everything. Yeah. Hi there, Martha.
Hey.
You want to sit with us?
We have about 3 minutes.
3 minutes? Okay.
Is that enough?
Well, it's not enough for us to discuss the most important topic. Why are you so beautiful?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Travel right till the end.
That's me.
And I'm letting you go back to the stylistic motif of Comrade Alexandrov.
Uh-huh. And there's another narrator in there, too.
Yes.
Which is this this unnamed German Nazi guy who's sort of a low-level guy. He comes in, you know, in the mobilization chapter, and then he's there, you know, near the very end, you know, in Lost Victories, and he pops up from time to time, and he obviously doesn't have the same status that Comrade Alexandrov does. He's probably less evil and more pathetic. And I made him so because we tend to think of, you know, the Soviets as being a little less evil and more pathetic in that war, just because they were attacked and they suffered so much, you know? So I want to try and keep things neutral.
Well, you also have very much fun with these various voices, like, you know, oh yes, I know all about it because I was the one who sort of found the sort of thing. And it seemed to me in Europe Central that the narrator was more of a sort of like really kind of, you were having a special, a good amount of fun with this.
And the German guy is basically, even though he's a Nazi and does terrible things, he's probably, at least for a while, somewhat nice, you know, or not, he means well and so forth, whereas Comrade Alexandrov is always nasty.
Yeah.
I know you have to get going. I'll ask you one final question, although I have several here. you've pointed out that you are sort of, you don't care about the publishing marketplace in other interviews. And yet, there is a part of you, I would argue, that is very much a sort of entrepreneur. For example, the Horse for Gloria screenplay, which you apparently banged off in 5 hours and collected $20,000. You sure there isn't some sort of, like, you know, Bill Voltman's money secrets here? Or
well, Ed, I believe in, like, a good Marxist proletariat and making enough money to reproduce my labor. And if I can negotiate a little bit more out of this publisher or that publisher, I will gladly do it. And if I could double my advances, would I write half as many books? I don't know. I have fun writing my books. I'm happy with my life. You know, my father always says, you know, if it's raining pennies, you better put your hat out and catch them. So who's to say, right? I probably would keep writing. On the assumption that sooner or later people would stop paying me. There's no job security whatsoever in my line of work. I'm only, you know, a literary writer. I'm not a commercial writer. I can't aspire to making any significant money. You know, the National Book Award was very nice, and my first offer for the notebook was $5,000. You know, I've spent $30,000 on it so far. So that's the reality. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to do whatever I can do. And if I can be a little shrewder than my stupid face indicates, nothing wrong with that either.
Well, I know you have to go. Bill, pleasure talking with you.
Oh, you too, man.
Thanks.